Welcome to the Northbound Wealth Podcast. All opinions expressed by me, my co-hosts, or my guests are solely our own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Northbound Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not intended as personalized recommendations or fiduciary advice. It is not intended to provide and should not be relied upon for any investment, accounting, legal, and tax advice or as a solicitation to offer or buy any securities. Clients of Northbound Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Hello, everyone. This is March 25th, 2024. This is the Northbound Wealth Podcast. Let's dive in. Stocks posted their best week of the year, sparked by news that the dovish Fed decided to keep rates steady and signaled three rate cuts still possible this year. Stocks bounced back. So, as widely expected, the Fed left rates unchanged at the conclusion of its two-day meeting, but somewhat less expected, the Fed signaled its inclination to cut rates three times this year, each time by a quarter percentage point. That was a positive surprise for some who worried that the recent hot inflation reports would cause the Fed to reconsider its stance. Markets pushed higher Wednesday following the news, with all three averages closing at record highs. The rally continued through Thursday, boosted further by news that existing home sales rose 9.5% in February. This week's rally was broad-based overall, with 10 of the 11 S&P 500 sectors posting gains. Healthcare dropped slightly. At one point late in the week, nearly one in four S&P 500 stocks were trading at 52-week highs. That's substantial. That's a big difference than 2023. That was the highest proportion in 3 years, which supports the idea that the rally was broadening out from the mega cap tech stocks or the Mag 7. So looking at on my blog, Y Charts, Weekly Market Insights, Major Index Return Summary, the Dow Jones Industrial Average year-to-date trailing number is up 5.25%. The one-year trailing number is up 25.86%. MSCI EAFE Index, which tracks overseas stock markets, it was up 5.74% for the year and up 19.25% as far as a trailing return, 12-month trailing return. NASDAQ Composite's up 9.63% with a 41.90% increase over the last 12 months trailing. S&P 500's up 10.12% for the year and has a trailing 12-month of 35.06%. And obviously, that's great news. That's up substantially from the terrible year we had in 2022. For those of you who are invested in the market at that time, stocks and bonds did horribly, down like 25% and 16% respectively, as if you look at the AG, Barclays AG, and then the S&P 500. So taking a look at the 10-year note, we're at the latest value that it closed at last Friday was 4.22%. Looking at the one-year change, that's up 21.26%. The three-month change is up 8.21%, and the one-month change is down 2.54%. So basically what we've looked at just a month ago, the 10-year Treasury note closed at 4.33%. 3 months ago, it was at 3.9%, and then 1 year ago, it was at 3.48%. So we'll be tracking the 10-year and the stock market and the equity indexes as we grind and ratchet along through the end of this first quarter. It's been pretty awesome to see. Thank you, Y Charts, data through March 23rd, 2024. Turning point, the Federal Open Market Committee, or the FOMC decision, marks a turning point as the Fed signaled that its target rate of 5.25% to 5.5% has topped out. That target range in place since last year is the highest level in 23 years, so more than two decades. We believe that our policy rate is likely at its peak for this type of cycle, was quoted Fed Chair Powell at the post-meeting press conference. He added that if the economy continues on its current course, that the FOMC would likely begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year. If the FOMC votes to ease at its June meeting, that would be the first cut in 4 years. And if they do that, it's probably a 25 basis point cut. This week, key economic data that we're tracking, new home sales today, which is Monday, Tuesday, durable goods orders, Case-Shiller Home Price Index, Wednesday, the EIA Petroleum Status Report, Survey of Business Uncertainty, Thursday, gross domestic product, jobless claims, consumer sentiment, pending home sales, Friday, personal income and outlays, and international trade in goods, retail inventories as well, Friday. So more and more data coming out to be trying to read into as far as where the economy is headed. Notable companies reporting earnings this week, because obviously we don't report all earnings. It would take too long. Tuesday, McCormick & Company, Dave & Buster's Entertainment, Wednesday, Paychex, Carnival Corporation, Cintas, and then Thursday, Walgreens Boots Alliance. The tax tip of the week, rules for home office deductions. If you have a business and you work out of your home, the IRS allows you to deduct certain expenses on your return. Here are a few key things to keep in mind. The IRS requires you to use your office or part of your home for, quote, regular and exclusive use, end quote. The part of the house should be your principal place of business, a place where you meet customers, or a separate structure dedicated to the business, like a garage or a studio or a side office. To calculate your deduction, you can use one of two methods. Number one, the simplified option allows you to multiply the allowable square footage of your office by $5, up to a maximum of 300 square feet. Number two, the regular method shows you to specifically calculate the actual expenses, such as rent, mortgage interest, taxes, repairs, depreciation, and utilities you pay for the portion of your home used for the business. You must determine the percentage devoted to business activities if you were to use only part of a space for your business. All right, this information is not intended to be a substitute for specific individualized tax advice. We suggest that you discuss your specific tax issues with a qualified tax professional, and this tip was adapted from IRS.gov. Moving on to the next segment, stay tuned, it's a good show for you. Hello everyone, this is the Northbound Wealth Technical Analysis Spotlight, and I just want to point out that the S&P 500, the Dow, and the NASDAQ have made multiple all-time highs in the beginning quarter of 2024. And with that, we're getting a little bit of weakness and a slight pullback away from those all-time high pushes. And I want to just talk about a few charts. First of all, the S&P 500 bullish percent index indicator. This one is one I pull from Stock Charts. I use their platform. They allow me an opportunity to look at a lot of different indicators and do charting analysis. So what I did was I went into that system. You may be able to go out there somewhere and type in $BPSPX and get the bullish percent index indicator. Typically, you'll set that up with a relative strength indicator, a MACD indicator, and look at some price action in the S&P 500. And then you can definitely see where this indicator lands and the momentum of it and that type of thing. And right now we're sitting at 73.6% bullish. And so that's definitely up from, let's see, October, November of 2023, we're sitting at 25% bullish. So use that as a comparison. It wasn't too long ago, we were sitting at a low, low level, a level that even during the early parts of 2023, we didn't see, and it was retested and put in a little bit lower low. It was near just below 30 at 27. So sitting at 73.6, you're seeing quite a bit of bullishness. It was as high as 80 or 90, some of the higher levels we've seen on that ratio. So know that the market participants are thinking that they're awfully bullish, but it has come pulled back from highs. Now we're going to jump over to the New York Stock Exchange, or the NYSE, McKellen Summation Index Ratio Adjusted, EOD, index. So I've got a full stochastics here. On the first study, the second study, and the first study is the 5-3, and then the second study is the 14-3. And then I've got down below on the third study, the New York Stock Exchange, NYC daily, and the volume and the price action of the SPX. And so I have got all of those studies pulled up, and I'm basically looking at a daily chart, and it's 1 year. And the first study, stochastic, which is quicker moving, and the exponential moving average is at nearly 100 with the black line, which is the full stochastic, and it's at 97.33 on the second study. And then the third, we're sitting at movement higher at 853 spot 66. And we've got a price in the S&P 500 at this point, and the data is as of the 22nd, so close of Friday. So there's a bit of a lag, but the price is for the S&P 500 or the SPX is 5,234 at that point. And today it's trading at 5,222. So it's kind of weakened a little bit from there, but down again from the very beginning of the year. It was all the way, the market was, internals were really busting up through seams. It was above 1,000, nearly 1,100 on that, on that marker. All right. That's my third indicator. I'm going to go to my fourth indicator. New York Stock Exchange, again, McKellen Summation Index, ratio adjusted. And this data is also as of Friday, so the 22nd. And I'm seeing prints on the first study of 95 spot 95, and then another one at 50 spot 71. A little bit of weakening going on there, but not a whole lot. It's still pretty, very bullish. There's still participation going on with volumes and things, but down again, a little bit of weakness from the beginning of the year. We're kind of retracing, coming back up a little bit, but we'll see where it goes from here. I have a four-year chart on this one, just so I can zoom out a little bit. It gives me a better perspective on what to look for and look at. The monthly candlestick, so the S&P 500 or dollar sign SPNX, S&P 500 large cap index. I got the relative strength indicator up top, the oscillator there, and we're definitely in overbought territories. Printing anything above 70 is overbought. Anything below 30 is oversold, and we're at 84.40, which means we're in an overbought condition on the monthly chart. This data is as of the 25th. So far the trading day hasn't ended. We got 30 more minutes, but it looks like the S&P 500 is trading at 5,223 spot 13. Again, just a continuing dominance of this trend line up and to the right that's bullish, coming out of obviously the 2009 Great Recession. And then we've got COVID in there, and we've got all kinds of stuff in here, but definitely bullish chart. Probably going to remain bullish for a while. We're going to get some pullbacks in between, but we'll wait to see what happens here. I happen to be running it for the last 20 years. So it goes back to 2004 all the way to now. And it's pretty awesome to see if you invest and participate in the equity markets, how much money you can make. It's nice. Let's see. I'm going to jump to now. Let's see. Let's look at the VIX. Everybody likes to look at the VIX. Let's look at the VIX. We got a VIX print right now of 13.18. That's low on historical average purposes. Normally we're hovering around 15 or so, and we're definitely not at 15. I think the 40 week or the 200 day moving average for the VIX is 14.66. We literally haven't traded really above that 15 level, but a few times here going back over the last, since the beginning of the year. Actually, if we go all the way back to November of 23, was really the last time. There was a spike in February that had us above a few times. We're getting a rip in the market when the VIX drops down. You normally see the market go up, and if we get spikes in the VIX, you see the market go down. So that's the relationship between the VIX and the market. traditionally. It doesn't mean it's always the case, but it is now at the moment. So let's take a look at some charts. The S&P 500, $SPX, that's the 500 largest companies in the United States. I've got price action. I've got full stochastics. I've got all kinds of fun jazz on this chart. But what I want to point out on this one, which if you guys have the ability at home, you can do this on like Yahoo Finance or anywhere like this, is put in the 200-day moving average, the 50-day moving average. The 200-day moving average is sitting right around 4,604. The 50-day moving average is around 5,018. And we're trading at 5224, so well above the 50 and well above the 200-day moving average. There was quite the pivot at the towards the end of last year in price action. When we hit 4103, that was kind of like a bottom, and then we moved up all the way to 5224 in this impulse wave to the upside. And it's been substantial. The trend is your friend. The Fed and the markets, AI really was a pivot there, and we're bullish. It's a bullish chart pattern. Doesn't mean it'll go on forever, but it's a nice wave to be riding, and we're happy about that. So know that we're a long way from the 200-day moving average. So, you know, if we get a really, it's like some unforeseen shock to the market, like we go to war or something like that happens, we could see a correction that retraces about 50% of this move from 4103 to 5224. We could see a 50% retrace. It happens a lot and it's normal. So don't be surprised if we get a pullback in the market. That just means it's an opportunity potentially to look at for your portfolios, not giving investment advice, but just keep that in mind. So let's talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is on stockcharts.com. If we type in $INDU, that pulls up the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index. Of course, I've got the multiple studies on here, and I really like taking a look at the charts. And so when I look back at the 200-day and the 50-day moving average, which are simple moving averages that anybody can type into, say, Yahoo Finance or Google or somewhere, or into Schwab, the Schwab platform, if you're one of my clients, 32,300 was a low that happened at the end of October, and we really haven't looked back. The market ripped higher all the way to 39,900 and change. Right now it's 39,312. The 50-day moving average is at 38,600, so we're above that. And then all the way down at 35,800 is the 200-day moving average. So obviously, this move or this impulse move wave in the market is going to be pulling up the 50-day and the 200-day moving average as time goes on. We could get a pullback, and if we do, we might see a retracement of around 50% of that move. If you're looking at Fibonacci numbers, that could possibly happen, and that would be normal. It would be okay. So then might be an opportunity for you to gain a little bit more exposure to the Dow 30 companies, if that's your prerogative. The Dow has really rallied since the end of 2022. It was at 28,700 in October of 22. And basically it's quite a, it kind of, it shot up a little bit to 34,700, kind of was range bound for a while throughout most of 2023 until October or November of 2023, when it hit 32,300 level, and then rocketed up to 39,312. So all-time highs historically. It's pretty awesome. All right. Again, that's $INDU if you want to really track the index, and then do the 50-day, 200-day moving average for those, just to get a broad-based view of the Dow 30 stocks of the U.S. The NASDAQ is the next stock chart that I like to look at. $COMPQ. COMPQ, that's the one in stock charts that I look at. We've got, again, a daily chart, the 50-day moving average, the 200-day moving average, and you're looking at, in November of 2023, 12,543 being a low, and then it ripped up to 16,413 spot 97 as of today. That's quite a move. Substantial move to the upside, which a lot of my clients participated in, which is cool because they have exposure to the tech sector. And we always have some allocation to tech because it is innovative. It is where money is being made. So that's where the market's trading at right now for the NASDAQ, 16,413. The 50-day is at 15,802. And then you've got the 200-day down at 14,348. So the 200-day is like a 40-week window. And that's broadly how you kind of gauge where the market's at. And we could still see a 50% correction Fibonacci-wise there and be okay and not worry too much about it. Let's see on the weekly chart. And if I pull a weekly chart, I just change the chart from daily to weekly and it changes the dynamics of where things are at. But if I go back again, 10,088 spot 83. So around just over 10,000 was where the NASDAQ Composite Index was trading at the end of 2022. And from there, it literally went up. I mean, it just blew out that 15,901 level at the very end of 21, beginning of 22. It surpassed that, made all-time highs, which is fantastic for those of you invested. Along the way, there were some pullbacks and some corrections, but those are normal parts of processes where the equity markets are making all-time highs. And if you listen to this podcast a while back, I was talking about, you know, it's a bear market, and then things started to really rip at the end of 2022, and that started to change the dynamics of the market and also the narrative. And then in 23, AI came about, and then 23 was a great year. And then here we are in 24, continuing that momentum to all-time highs across all three indexes, and we really needed the NASDAQ to follow through. I think first we had the Dow, and then the S&P, and then the NASDAQ, or it might've been the S&P first, and then the Dow, and then the NASDAQ. And normally, I don't see that all the time where it takes the tech sector to be the final one to follow through on it. So I'm excited about it. Now's the time to be thinking about asset allocation, just like you were back when the market was down. And so we'll make adjustments as necessary, and hopefully the review of the charting and the analysis of markets helps kind of hear what we're looking at and what we're tracking going forward. We don't expect markets to go up in a straight line. So pullbacks are normal. They're typical. They are expected. So don't be surprised if we get one. It's just an opportunity to reposition or add more and that type of thing. And if you're sitting on the sidelines, well, hopefully you're in treasuries making 5%, which is nice. So we'll follow the Fed. We'll see what the Fed is doing. And that will dictate future earnings and where the markets are going fundamentally. So we'll keep you posted and stay tuned for the next segment. Hello, everybody. This is Brent Foster, Northbound Wealth Podcast. Thanks for listening and tuning in. I just love the daily upside. I subscribe to it. I get emails every day that have newsworthy and informational content that is timely. I'm going to dive into a few articles I find noteworthy, and I'll share those with you guys and provide some insight and reaction. All right, so Apple might team up with Google to put AI in iPhones. Okay, since we all use an iPhone pretty much, those with Androids, sorry, this one's I guess not for you. The digital devil, you know, Apple is in discussions with Google about integrating Google's generative AI software Gemini into its hardware offering. Sources told Bloomberg that might initially seem counterintuitive. Google is Apple's only competitor when it comes to operating systems on phones. However, it wouldn't be their first deal. In fact, the way Apple was previously baked Google products into its iPhones has been subject of intense antitrust scrutiny. They're kind of like strange bedfellows. Apple has been characteristically tight-lipped about how it plans to hop on the generative AI hype train, but it feels like the company was caught off guard as the AI boom started to blossom. Apple's secrecy around its generative AI strategy managed to cheese off both investors' worry about its safety and investors jonesing for the company to keep pace with other big tech companies. Apple CEO Tim Cook said last month that generative AI features could come into some of its devices sometime this year. And Bloomberg's reporting suggests it's looking to outsource the endeavor rather than to build the software in-house. Sources told Bloomberg that Apple had also held talks with OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. If Apple does end up striking a deal with Google, however, that could be a red flag into antitrust regulators. So here's a couple of them. During the Department of Justice antitrust lawsuit against Google last year, a key area of focus was the deal that Google had struck in 2003 with Apple, which set Google's search engine as the default search engine on Apple's Safari browser. And it emerged during the trial that Google pays Apple as much as $26 billion per year to keep that deal in place. And then number two, the deal, prosecutors argued, helped cement Google's considerable dominance in the search engine market. The trial wrapped up in November and the judge set closing arguments for May of this year. So we have a couple of months before we find out how well the DOJ made its case. A new generative AI deal would presumptively cut in the other direction with Apple licensing out Google's tech. But bear in mind that Microsoft recently paid news organization Semaphore to integrate ChatGPT into its output. And there's a regulatory gravitational pull. Apple is in the process of beating a fairly tactical regulatory retreat in the EU, which is the European Union. Last week, the iPhone maker announced it would scrap a long-standing policy that prevented people from using its devices to download apps off the web, meaning they would have to use its bespoke app store. That came just a week after the EU slapped Apple with a $2 billion fine over how the company dictates terms to music streaming apps. You just got to keep walking it off, Apple. I love that. That article was written by Isabel Asher Hamilton at the Daily Upside. Great job. Let's see. Here is the next article that I wanted to cover, and it has to do with Deloitte, a major Big Four accounting firm, and it's restructuring a company basically with 455,000 employees worldwide. That is a head-spinning task. Thankfully, these are accountants we're talking about. Deloitte, the biggest of the world's Big Four accounting firms, is undergoing a massive organizational restructuring. The Financial Times reported on Monday. The group presumptively did some good note-taking during rival Ernst & Young's failed restructure and split-off last year. Account to four. What those versed in corporate speak call reorgs or reorganizations is what the rest of us simply call cost-cutting. And at Deloitte, the motivation behind restructuring is no different. Not that it seems completely necessary either. In 2023, it reported revenue of $65 billion. A 15% jump from 2022. However, that was slower growth than the rate of 22% top line spike from 2021. Translation, Deloitte is at the tail end of a massive growth spurt that sought firmly cement itself as the industry's biggest player. And with likely headwinds in the year to come, the company is looking to simplify. According to an internal email seen by the Financial Times, the new look Deloitte will center around four business units, down from five previously. So there's audit and assurance, tax and legal, strategy, risk and transactions, which will house its M&A business and technology and transformation. The changes will save costs, but how much has yet to been calculated, according to a source who spoke with the Financial Times in the email to staff, global CEO, Joe, and I don't even know how to say this guy's name, Kazolgu, who is leading the reorg, said the moves are intended to allow partners to spend more time with clients and less time managing internal staff. In the Ernst & Young and the Restless, the change is hard for anyone, and planned restructuring is apparently a fairly divisive topic internally, one former partner told the Financial Times. Still, Kazulu is deliberately choosing not to repeat the mistakes of Ernst & Young's blundered restructuring when plans to split its audit and financial consulting firms into two separate businesses fell apart as leaders couldn't agree on how to split up the tax businesses. While some of the others are in the market looking to break this function apart, we believe that our fully integrated suite of tax and legal capabilities is a significant source of strength and differentiation and aligns with the needs of our clients. Kasugo wrote in his email to partners, in the world of Big Four, stay together for the tax accountant seems to be reason enough to avoid divorce. Written by Brian Boyle over at the Daily Upside. Really like that one. That's excellent. Thanks for that article. Continuing on, we're going to dive into Uber. Can rideshare giant Uber sustain its recent success? We own Uber here at Northbound Wealth Management. We own Apple, and I'm just disclosing those as a firm. That's what we own. Generally, it looks, I like the charts on Uber, and Apple's has kind of got a pullback, but it's all good. Long-term for Apple. Let's see. It took well over a decade, but Uber has finally reached its destination and profitability. So for the first time ever, the rideshare giant and gig economy pioneer ended a full year in the black, generating an operating profit of $1.1 billion in 2023. That followed a loss of $1.8 billion in 2022, which capped a decade-long stretch of reporting cumulative losses that totaled just over a cool $31 billion. Other companies in the gig economy are similarly rounding into money-making maturity, but is it too late? A little too late, guys? I don't know. We'll see. Inflation and subsequent hikes in interest rates have cut off access to the ultra-cheap capital that Uber employed to launch a rapid global expansion. Meanwhile, regulation at the local, state, and federal levels is threatening to undermine a very gig-based labor model that Uber and similar companies are based on. The gig economy, finally having achieved sustainable levels of market dominance, may just be facing its biggest roadblocks yet. Put it in reverse. So Uber's playbook was simple: facilitate connections between people who need rides and people willing to drive around strangers in their own cars, thus creating a fleet of personal drivers while deftly or bluntly, depending on who you ask, skirting laws and rules regulating the taxi cab and commercial driving industries. But turning that into an actual business proved to be much more difficult. As a startup, Uber raised a total of $22.2 billion across 20 rounds ahead of its 2019 IPO, according to Crunchbase, with notable backers including SoftBank, Toyota, Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, so Sovereign Wealth Fund. Much of the VC's cash was funneled towards stabilizing the same delicate balancing act that continues to bedevil Uber and all gig economy apps to this day, subsidizing the cost of rides to attract customers with cheap fares. Remember when Ubering from the airport barely topped $12? Well, still paying enough to attract a fleet of willing drivers who relished the choose-your-own-hours flexibility of their independent contractor status. Fed up with the ludism of traditional taxi cabs, millennials in particular flocked to the app, and for years, Uber happily clung to a growth-at-all-cost strategy, with the cost, in this instance, the aforementioned $31 billion in cumulative losses. When the company went public in May of 2019 at an $80 billion valuation, down from its pre-IPO investment rounds that had valued the firm at as high as $120 billion, and quickly suffered the biggest first-day dollar loss in U.S. stock market history. The pandemic naturally crushed the company's business, but by 2023, strong demand returned and Uber, at long last, began adjusting its internal dials away from growth and toward profit. That was good for Uber shareholders, for everyone else. Well, last year, Uber drivers averaging monthly gross earnings fell by over 17%, according to the data analyzed by the research firm Gridwise Analytics. During a 45-month-long span that stretched from 2018 to 2022, Uber fares for riders increased 83%, according to Forbes data analysis, equivalent to four times the rate of inflation. Copycats. So, Uber's woes were not unique. Competitor Lyft, which has never turned an annual profit, has been forced to increase driver pay to attract drivers. Though motorists and its fleet still earn comparatively less than Uber, around $1,058 per month versus Uber's $1,409 per month per Gridwise Analytics, in February, Lyft said it would guarantee drivers a 70% commission for every ride. Lyft reported a $350 million loss in 2023, an improvement from the $1.6 billion loss the year before. The company's total cash on hand has dwindled to just under $1.7 billion, down from around $3.3 billion in 2019, so they're burning cash. Food courier service DoorDash, meanwhile, has also never turned an annual profit. Last year, the company reported $550 million in losses, an improvement from the $1.3 billion loss it suffered in 2022. In the pandemic years of 2020 and 2021, when restaurants were largely closed and takeout reigned supreme, DoorDash reported annual losses of more than $460 million each year. There are now roughly 1 billion workers employed by a gig economy app in one form or another. Can you believe that? 1.1 billion workers employed that way. According to recent investigation by the Financial Times and managing that fleet, setting wages and maintaining drivers without letting costs for customers get too high has been the tricky task that all Uber-esque companies face. But soon, these questions may largely be out of their hands. In January, the Biden administration signed an executive order which went into effect earlier this month, directing the Department of Labor to begin reclassifying gig workers from independent contractors to employees. If they are proven to be economically dependent or work from an app, the directive could grant workers stronger compensation benefits and legal protections. But Biden's order is just the latest, and perhaps the most legally loose, of a wave of legislation. High court judges in the UK, Canada, France, Switzerland, and elsewhere have declared that gig workers are employees and thus have the right to minimum wage, among other benefits. Uber typically has a lower market share in foreign countries compared to the US. In the US, state and local legislation has similarly pushed the bar higher. In 2019, California passed the high-profile Assembly Bill 5, which outlined stricter worker classification rules. Biden's order is largely based on this bill. But in 2021, an industry-backed ballot initiative in California, Proposition 22, walked back many of the new rules. Uber, Lyft, and fellow industry peers poured $200 million into a campaign to support the measure. Last year, New York City Mayor Eric Adams and the New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection announced that the Big Apple's 60,000 app-based food delivery drivers would be guaranteed an hourly minimum wage of $17.96 per hour, up from a current $7.09 per hour minimum wage. The rule goes into effect in May. Uber and Lyft have recently threatened to cease service in Minneapolis in response to a new minimum wage law, also set to go into effect in May. The state's governor has said he's seeking a compromise with the industry. The effects of new employee classification laws are already being felt. San Francisco city attorney reached a settlement with Quick, a company that operates an Uber for catering and restaurant staff app. Quick agreed to pay $1.5 million in back wages as well as $250,000 in penalties for misclassifying employees as independent contractors. It's the first known time in a modern gig company that the U.S. has acknowledged such a misclassification, Vina Dubal, a law professor at UC Irvine, told the LA Times. Still, the barrage of new laws at various levels may only create confusion, some argue. Overall, our labor markets are in constant flux, and there's little coherent and consistent guidance from lawmakers. Charles Krungle, who practices labor and employment law on behalf of businesses, told the Daily Upside, "Essentially, lawyers like myself stand to benefit the most from these changes." In other words, expect ongoing and expensive litigation as Uber and its industry peers continue to fight these new classifications. So what's the road ahead? Still, Uber may, for now, have a smooth road ahead of it. Demand for rides remains strong despite steady increases in prices, and its profitability and its profitable in 2023 has sent its share price to all-time highs, where it is still hovering. Last year, it also marked a new, perhaps telling, first for the company, the rollout of fully autonomous cars and its rideshare fleet with a partnership with Google's Waymo, bringing self-driving Ubers to the city of Phoenix, Arizona. Robots, of course, don't need a minimum wage, possibly solving Uber's unending battle with its gig workers. But Uber's history is full of always-on-the-horizon optimism, and an all-autonomous future might be no different. Prescott Watson, general partner at Red Blue Capital and a transportation-focused venture fund, explained to the Financial Times how robotaxi groups have been overly optimistic about the implementation of autonomous vehicles. You make a brain, but you have to train the brain for 6 months to drive in Phoenix and train that brain for 2 years to drive in Columbus, Ohio. And each of these cities' rollouts is another massive project. For the time being, Uber's shareholders understand that patience is a virtue. Again, this article is written by Brian Boyle. Great job, man. and love this article. Very insightful and informative. And again, you guys, subscribe to The Daily Upside. You'll stay in tune with a lot of cool stuff. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in to the Northbound Wealth Weekly Market Insights podcast with your host, Brent Foster. Thanks for listening, for following along, for subscribing and liking. Also, we hope that you guys have a wonderful week, and God bless you guys, and we'll talk to you next week.